Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me as usual is James. You can check out our website, MacGuffinMen.com, if you want to keep up on our most recent episodes. We most recently talked about Point Blank and The Limey, two movies, one podcast sort of thing. Before that was Seconds. Prior to that was The Shape of Water. Prior to that was Annihilation and A Serious Man. I've also written a couple things, most recently about the 2011 film Young Adult. So if you want to join me on a ride through the past of Diablo Cody's successes, you can check that out. Anyway, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are.
Yes.
On the beginning of our journey, of our fact-finding journey.
That we will go on three different times.
Yeah, this is going to be a very episodic podcast.
We're talking about The Lost City of Zed.
Yes.
And not just because we're in Canada is it called The Lost City of Zed. I remember being curious about that when it came out.
Exactly. That was something that, like, I went into this movie assuming it would constantly be pronounced as The Lost City of Z, and I never really put it together that it was not about American characters, because it was a James Gray film who was just so notably American. Like, he could not sound more like he's from New York. So, yeah, I was surprised and okay with it being called The Lost City of Z.
Yeah, I didn't realize that James Gray was so born and bred New Yorker.
Yeah.
And I was talking about when he was approached to do this movie, which has an interesting production history that we'll get into, I'm sure. But he said that it didn't take place in the past 10 years and it wasn't set in New York. So I don't know why they sent me this. Like, yeah. I guess he has a pretty small wheelhouse that this lies far outside of, in at least two respects.
Well, I mean, the yards and We Own the Night both take place in the 80s, I think, or maybe the yards is the 90s. Either way, he goes back, and also the immigrant hadn't been made by the time this book was given to him, but The Immigrant takes place in the 30s. So he goes further back in time than I think he gives himself credit for, but he is correct about the geography that he has covered in the past.
Yeah. And we're going to say a success, right?
The film?
Yeah.
From our perspectives, yes, absolutely. I don't know how the money people feel about it, but...
I know how the money people feel about it.
Yeah. I mean, one of them feels like, hey, I'm Brad Pitt. I don't really care.
That's right.
Yeah.
If I cared enough about this movie, I would have been in it.
I mean, I could see why you wouldn't want to make this movie. Seems like it was a pretty dangerous venture.
Yeah, it seems that way. And I mean, so...
So you think it's a success as well?
I do. I think it's a very interesting movie, and I think that there's a lot to talk about here, which is why I was excited that we talk about it. And I was kind of shocked we didn't talk about this when we both saw it in theaters the first time it came around.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes it's fun to let something have a little bit of air. Like, it's still really enjoyable to talk about a recent movie, but you know, sometimes some movies are worth having more time with, and I'm certainly happy to have watched it again almost a full year later, and I feel like I got more out of it this time. You know, I mean, we're kind of doing the same thing with Phantom Thread, although I guess you haven't seen Phantom Thread, but you know, some movies are worth a little bit of extra thought.
Right. And so it took us a while to get to it. Is it a 2009 book?
I feel like that sounds right. 2008 or 2009, one of the two. Published in February 2009, so he would have read it in 2008 because he read it before it was published.
Right. And we're talking about James Gray reading it.
Reading David Grand's book, yes.
Yes, reading David Grand's book, Lost City of Zed. And it was something that, as I said, it's kind of a bit of a storied history, in that it took a long time to get underway, and Brad Pitt's production company wanted to do it. And do you believe that Brad Pitt actually wanted to be in this, and that, or was that just kind of a way to get this moved along?
Oh, I definitely believe he wanted to be in it at a time, especially like late 2000s Brad Pitt. This really feels like something that I could see him being interested in. And then he has just finished this long journey movie, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and is like, that was like a lot, and I had to play a lot of different iterations of the same person over a long period of time, and maybe I don't want to go right back into doing that. Also, maybe I don't want to hang out in the jungle for a long period of time. Maybe he was concerned about whether or not he'd be able to find weed, you know?
Yes. And then it went to Benedict Cumberbatch, and then we ended up with your boy, Charlie Hunnam.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't even, like, I don't care for Charlie Hunnam. I think he has moments in this movie. I certainly do not think he is his performance is the high point of this movie. I mean, I think it's the biggest attraction, but I don't know that I would like it better with Benedict Cumberbatch though either. He's because just the way he plays, he tends to play roles in such a performative sort of way. Like someone, it feels like every time Benedict Cumberbatch reads a line, he's pronouncing it like I came from the theater, you know, like there's just some sort of like way that he reads his lines that just always sounds like somebody who would rather be on stage. And at least Charlie Hunnam doesn't have that. And I don't mean that as a talking shit about Benedict Cumberbatch because I find him very enjoyable in a lot of roles, but I don't know that I would have liked him better in this, you know?
Yeah, and I have I don't know, I feel a little distance from this movie. There's something about it that I don't know if it's because I think it deliberately doesn't want to be a pretty straightforward adventure movie or straightforward you know, biographical movie, that I don't know how much of that to chalk up to filmmaking and how much to chalk it up to the lead performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think we can put it all on the side of performance. Like, do you agree with me on Hunnam in this movie that he's kind of not, certainly not the high point of the film?
Oh yeah. That's definitely true. Okay. And as someone who just hasn't seen a lot of Charlie Hunnam, I don't bring a lot of I don't have a lot of exposure to, maybe he's doing something different here, or maybe he's doing something that the role calls for. And I've seen, I mean, there are plenty of good reviews of this movie, and some of them kind of agree with, you know, the positive spin on it, that Fawcett is a bit of a flawed character, and that this is he shouldn't be just this charismatic, kind of swashbuckling, magnanimous character that we're all drawn towards and love. And so there seems to be the reception of performances that they kind of vary between he's playing that character really well. He's absolutely crushing a performance that's based on that idea. But then there's also the one that, look, he's just not a great actor. He just doesn't have that natural charisma that we want from an A-list celebrity. And I think that those are both really valid ways to look at it.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely a very hard role to play. Like, for all the reasons that we've pointed out, you've got to play a person at so many different times of their lives. Going through a significant amount of personal change, and it's just difficult. But as somebody who has seen Charlie Hunnam in more things and has only liked him in comedy, I don't know. I just don't feel like anything in his career sort of makes me feel like I'm wrong. You know, I give him all credit for the fact that it's a very difficult role to do. And I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who definitely would have crushed it, except for people that always crush everything, like Tom Hardy or something. But those people are just so few and far between, you know?
Yeah, and I think that is sort of a microcosm of this whole movie being kind of slippery. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's interesting that kind of spans everything about this, that it seemed difficult to make, it seems like a hard character to pin down, it seems like a difficult story to sell, because, you know, it's based on this novel, which is based on a true story, and...
It's not a novel.
Oh, okay,
just,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, their source material that's based on a true story. And that there are some things that are so undeniably cinematic about it that it would make for a perfect film. You know, it's the source material that you hope for that you could make into a story. But in a way, in other ways, it doesn't lend itself very well to it. And as we kind of discussed, it's the central figure who is very flattened out for this movie, and I don't think is made to be 100% flawless in this, but is certainly less flawed and less dynamic than my understanding of the real Percy Fawcett.
Yeah, he's far more woke in the movie than he is in David Grant's book.
Yeah, and that sounds more like the real person instead of this is a historical figure who it seems like the personality was sucked out and then put through the lens of what Brad Pitt would want to play and then put into a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also, like, so much time has passed since, because you're 100% right about that Brad Pitt thing that I have not thought about. Like, that really does sound like it, the way you're describing it is like,
Robert Redford in 3 Days of the Condor.
Redford in 3 Days of the Condor, or Brad Pitt in 12 Years a Slave, you know, which is the perfect example of that for this situation. But is like so much time passed, and Brad Pitt like removed himself from this project by 2010, at least in a acting standpoint. So I find it hard to believe that the script didn't change in the intervening 8 years, you know, or sorry, 8 years, that's terrible math, 5 years before it probably would have went into actual production. I would imagine that elements of that remained attractive to James Gray. And as you said, it certainly feels like the type of character that has had some sort of Brad Pitt producer producing hand in it. And but yeah, I just don't think that all of this was written with Brad Pitt in mind, or at least it might have been initially and then was just sort of adjusted. And also right. Brad Pitt is pretty famous like Robert Redford for one of the million reasons why he's the easiest comparison point for Brad Pitt in Hollywood, is that he's famously kind of fickle about committing to projects, and he wants to have his hand in it the whole way through, especially something that he does through Plan B. But you're never really guaranteed to actually get Brad Pitt, you know, even though he's like, yeah, let's do this, James. Even though he's the person calling you saying, hey, James, I've got this book, let's boogie or something. There's some quote, James Gray talks about the first call he got about this book was from Brad Pitt, and he does a really funny Brad Pitt impression and, and says, like, just talks just like Brad Pitt. It's kind of funny. But yeah, like, I see this movie as having definitely gone through a lot of changes since Brad Pitt would have left the role. I feel like a lot of the Nina stuff was a later addition, like a post Brad Pitt addition. You know?
Yeah,
I think the stuff that makes this movie, for the most part, to me, stand out from other movies like it is the stuff involving Nina, and it sort of feels like something that is found over time as somebody is living with this book and reading it over and over again. And David Grann focuses only a little bit on Nina, but some of those details, obviously I read the book after seeing the movie, so I can't totally remove myself from that. But some of those details really do jump out at you, and you can sort of see where James Gray would at least think, we should put something like this in, and then sort of start to consider Nina's side of things more. And, you know, through reading about this movie, it actually sounds like him and Sienna Miller tried to develop the character a bit more as time progressed, because she felt like she always played the wife that just sat by the window watching the breeze, you know. She didn't get to have any action, and she kind of still does here, but it's a much more fully formed character than that version that we're used to.
Yeah, it was interesting hearing Sienna Miller talk about the roles that she's played like that. And I think, what was it? We've talked about her before, and that you're not a fan. Yeah, not crazy. Maybe Live by Night?
That's the only movie I can think of that we've both seen that she is in, off the top of my head. But
yeah.
Also, of all the movies for us to both have seen.
Really? But I remember you saying that, you know, you're not the biggest fan of her, but you know, we've never really said anything about who she is personally. I'm not surprised that she is self-aware enough to realize that she's kind of found herself in roles like that often, and why she would want to have something different. And so instead of her just being this this object of that represents what you're missing at home, like this symbol of domesticity, and you know, you could just be at home on the couch with your wife instead of going and doing these adventures, that she has some part in it. You know, she wants to have more of a role in it, but we still see her as the person who finds this text that backs up the ideas that he's putting forward, and at least has some discussion with Percy about what to do and what to do with their children and what it means that he's gone all the time. So for her to have more agency in this story, I think is one of the smarter things about this movie too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that again is sort of what helps differ it from some of these or differentiate it from a lot of other journey movies. Like the one that's always going to be in my mind is Apocalypse Now, because it's the first real like journey movie that I saw, grand journey movie, or something like Lawrence of Arabia. Like those movies don't come back home, you know, and this one does a couple times, and you need to have characters that are with you while you're at home, but you also need to keep like reaching out to them a little bit, like through the film, while a character like Percy is on one of his three journeys in this movie, you know?
Yeah, not to count World War One.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think talking about things that were found in the book and or changed. I think Percy went on like 8 voyages in real life, and James Gray was like, "Well, we obviously can't show 8, so we've got to do 3."
Yeah, and that was kind of one thing I was getting at earlier about how it's simultaneously so perfect for this and so not perfect for this, is that the journey movie is typically you either go and you don't come back, or you go there and back. And that's the structure of it. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's not what this is. And I think that's one of the things that lends this to being one, just more of a unique movie, and two, it just gives it a bit more of that, mesmerizing, absorbing feel that I think people often credit it with, is that this idea of kind of going back and forth and finding yourself in that same position. But I do want to plant a flag in bringing up Apocalypse Now, because it's one that it struck me as watching it, and it didn't take me long to realize that I'm not that smart. Everyone's gonna kind of notice this whether they should or not. And you know, another journey movie, another kind of plagued production in the jungle that is kind of famously terrible. And I want to know your thoughts on the comparison between the two, if it's simple as that, or if there's more to it.
Yeah, I kind of see it to an extent, but also mostly just in the idea that there's this singular male who is going on this journey and has an endpoint that he has to get to, but the motivations for getting places are totally different. Kurtz has to kill somebody when he gets there. He doesn't really have anything driving him besides just being told that this is what he is meant to do. He's meant to go and execute somebody with extreme prejudice, I believe. Whereas Percy Fawcett his perspective on what he's doing seems to change pretty quickly over the course of the movie, at least in the first half, where he is doing this because he feels like he's just another person wearing a red coat, just another member of the military at the beginning, which is shown in one of my favorite shots of the movie, but we'll talk about that. And then as time progresses, he is at the Royal Geographical Society, and they're like, oh, this will be a good way to build a reputation. And then while he's on that first journey, he sees the evidence of another civilization, like with the pottery and stuff like that. And then he sort of starts to think that maybe this is just, I mean, he vocalizes this at the dinner where Murray says, welcome to the inner circle. Where he says we should go back more from an archaeological perspective than a map making sort of perspective. And he's just a person that is more in flux than my recollection of Kurtz. And also just from the production, like Apocalypse Now is, I can't imagine any production of any film ever being more difficult than Apocalypse Now. And I mean, like, in the past and also
because
in the future.
Because Marlon Brando was there. But,
because Marlon Brando was there and Francis Ford Coppola is kind of a nut. And I mean that in the most pleasant way possible. But just all of these reasons and the fact that nobody will ever let a movie like Apocalypse Now be made again. At least, like, in the actual, like, jungle. So I think that's going to, at the end of cinema, going to be the hardest movie that was ever made, or the most difficult movie that was ever made. And so even kind of comparing the process that Gray and Company went through to make The Lost City of Zed kind of feels very small in comparison. But there was real significant danger. I think somebody was bit in the neck by a viper on the crew in the last couple days, you know, like... A river they were in flooded in like 45 seconds or something, and they had to, like, the cameraman's running with the camera on top of his head to like pass it to people on shore. Anyway,
yeah,
so I just think like there are definite similarities, and you're right that pretty much everybody that has talked about Velocity of Zed in any capacity, including James Gray, has pointed out those comparisons. But aside from the military and just a endpoint that this character has in their head, I think there's a lot more difference than a lot more differences than it might seem like from afar. You know? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do, and I kind of want to go back to what you had said about Kurtz and a large discussion about character motivation, because and I want to tie this into a movie that this is very dissimilar to on the surface, and I imagine the production as well. But in thinking about Brad Pitt movies, this has one comparison to Moneyball that I want to get your thoughts on. So the idea in Moneyball, at least in the film, and it's touched on pretty explicitly, probably around the halfway to two-thirds points in the movie, is that Billy Bean had everyone tell him one thing about who he is, and that ended up not to be the case. And he wants to, you know, someone says that you don't want this to happen to other people, essentially, that they're going to take all these non-empirical things out of the way people look at baseball players and, you know, have kind of a more honest representation of what people are. Mm-hmm. And to connect that to this movie, we see that Fawcett's motivation at the beginning of this seems to be to overcome this, I don't know, what his father has done to his reputation, that his father is one day a seemingly wealthy, perhaps aristocratic person who lost it all to gambling and drinking, it seems. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of touched on briefly, but that seems to be what kind of spurs Fawcett on to doing anything, right? He wants to... his career, or he feels that at least that is what's stopping him from furthering his career, and to overcome that is going to be what furthers his career. And so initially it seems to be his mission is to do what is, you know, this very a surveying job, you know, to find this river or find a line between these two countries that are at war over the rubber trade, and that will help him kind of overcome what his father has done to their family name. And then eventually we learn that, you know, we learn about this city that he believes might have been there. And as we see with that initial meeting at the, well, not the initial meeting, but the Royal Geographical Society, when he makes his presentation and takes questions from the audience, I suppose.
The questions that he does not necessarily want to be taking. But
in one of my favorite scenes in this movie, for reasons much different than why I like the rest of this movie.
I think it's the best scene in the movie.
Yeah?
Just from a pure entertainment standpoint, absolutely. And yeah, it's Hunnam's best scene, unquestionably. And it's just, it's just a very engaging scene.
Yeah, and that's another thing about that Hunnam performance, is that there's one where he does just to get to be this kind of charismatic person who just kind of deflects things and makes himself look good, and I think he does that well, which makes me think that some of the more nuanced stuff is intentional and not just flat. But I'll put in that for now. So when he's kind of defending that maybe white people weren't the start of civilization, and that maybe they didn't invent pottery, and that someone before England might have been capable of producing something like that, which we now know to be obviously true. How does that line up with him kind of in that initial character motivation of just kind of outdoing what everyone thinks, like that there's something more to just the status that you're born into, and that kind of some more of those woke Brad Pitt moments about overcoming the stereotypes and the biases that the culture around you has created.
How does the Royal Geographical Society play into that, that scene?
Well, I guess just where do you draw the line between, or not where do you draw the line between, but do you see a significant shift in his motivations between those that his desire to outdo, you know, his station in life as a result of his father's action is mm-hmm. directly linked to trying to give a bit more credit to just any not white, not English person?
Yeah, I think so. My take on the film's sort of the way that they present Percy as somebody who wants some sort of reputation is that pretty much once he, at the end of that first trip, first voyage, once he sort of discovers that he thinks Zed is real, it really feels like reputation goes out the window. And he kind of doesn't really care about it anymore. We see one point late in the movie where he kind of, or later in the movie during the World War One scene, where he kind of laughs at Murray dying, at least certainly probably being on the verge of death up in the Arctic. But outside of that, it seems like he kind of has his one purpose, and it doesn't really seem like he cares about his father anymore. It doesn't seem like he cares about his kids anymore, you know? And so I don't know. I view the movie as something that is started by reputation, but I think at least from Percy's perspective, pretty soon into the movie, I don't think he cares anymore, or at least the way that the movie presents him as somebody that doesn't care anymore. And he just sort of slowly gets to a point, or I suppose in the case of the movie, relatively quickly gets to a point where it's that first trip that changes him, and everything that comes afterwards is only slight changes on what is the big change that has already happened. You know, it's like the big character transformation in this movie happens quietly at the end of the first act, you know, and it's him finding pottery.
Yeah. I'm just really interested in that transition. Is that a transition of he knows this thing is true, and now he wants to prove that he's a good explorer? Or does he want to prove to the upper crust of British society that your understanding of everybody else in the world, whether it be people from a different class within Britain or mm-hmm. people within the same class who have, you know, parents who have done this thing, or whether it be civilizations on a different continent, that you guys are wrong about this, and he's going to prove it in this very grand historical way, but it's attached to his more personal struggle?
Yeah. Oh, I definitely agree that, like, that is the way that it would be perceived from afar, especially in the way that people like this were reported on at the time. But just the way that the movie presents Percy from that beginning, and it's just sort of like he sees these pieces of pottery and then starts to realize that his guide was probably right, that there is a Zed, and he becomes obsessed with finding it. And I think that is sort of what helps him reframe the things that he has seen along the way in his journey, the plantation that they pass through, and which he doesn't really bat an eye at as they're passing through. But once he realizes that towards the end of the journey, and again, this is all me projecting on things that I see. These things aren't vocalized. He sort of starts to reframe his own perspective on other people. And that's when, at that inner circle dinner where he meets Murray, they're talking about the article he wrote in the Times about the slave trade in the Americas. And he's just talking about how, you know, it feels like he has had his perspective reframed by that by that voyage, and he had a long time to think about it on the way back. And what came back off the boat was somebody who was going to write an anti-slavery article in "quote unquote" the Times. You know?
Yeah, and I, with these dirty movies, like there's often, you know, someone goes mad, you know, or finding madness. And is this an example of someone who gets fixated on this idea and has to prove it just for some selfish reasons? Or is there some larger, you know, anthropological justice that needs to be done? And, you know, or is it hubris, or what is it that's really driving him at this point? Or is it still related back to every time, you know, some British guy with a mustache said you had the wrong ancestors or whatever, right?
Yeah, no, his desires are selfish, but those desires go hand in hand with his belief that the white man isn't necessarily right all the time, you know. But I do think what really drives him every time he goes out is the purely selfish desire to find this city, and as a side note, to be the person remembered as finding the city. But I do think just the way that the movie presents Percy, it presents him as somebody that definitely wants to be the person remembered for finding the city. But he also wants to at least use that as some sort of way to talk about how the white man isn't the end all and be all of human existence. You know, because there's that there's that line when he's talking to the fortune teller in the trenches in World War One. And they sort of get transported to the jungle, or at least he does, and then she's on a green screen. And he says something along the lines of, our world has set itself on fire. I must look elsewhere to quench the blaze. And that's later than the moment that I'm talking about, where he sort of starts to have his big character shift. But I think that sort of sums up just how he feels about the society that he has lived in, and the class structure that he's in, and just a certain willingness to look elsewhere for ideas. And again, it is attached to a purely selfish desire to find Zed and to be the person who found Zed. But I do think he's looking because he's realized that things aren't exactly all right in the part of the world that he is in.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And they talk about the slave trade, as you mentioned, and they talk about, there's just a lot of talk about other groups of people in this, or disagreements between groups of people. And obviously it seems as though, you know, the biggest one is the, you know, upper class British, who in this one is the Royal Geographical Society, and the, you know, people who may or may not have existed who had this advanced society in the area that he's exploring. And I think there's also a bit of anti-Americanism in there too. When they talk about the American explorers and bringing too many guns that they might destroy what they're looking for.
Yeah. Well, and also despite the fact that there are scenes in this movie where we actually see Percy at war shooting at the enemy, he is kind of a pacifist, at least by the standards of the other people he is traveling with in this movie. There are multiple times in this movie where he stops other people from firing guns. And, you know, he realizes that the way to continue or to best go through this journey is to present himself as an ally, as opposed to an enemy, as opposed to shooting at people. It's to take off his bandana and say amigos over and over again, you know? And that's something I also find very interesting about Percy's character in this film, and something that sticks out in a positive fashion for me.
Yeah, and someone who, just to speak another language, right?
Yeah.
That's a big step in this movie. But talking about the groups, I mean, Victorian era England, famously rigid class structure. And then we also see that even within this pretty exclusive society that Percy's in at the starting of the movie, that he's sort of on the bottom rung of it, and he feels he can never kind of elevate, which is what motivates him at the beginning, it seems. And I think one of the interesting things that this movie does is kind of cast Percy in that light. You know, he's on the right side of all of these issues. You know, people shouldn't judge him by what his father did. People shouldn't be so exclusive in their societies. People shouldn't assume that there couldn't have been a civilization on this continent because it's not white Europeans. And so we really take his side for a lot of it, and then we get him talking to his wife, and it kind of puts him on the wrong side of history to talk about women the way that he does. And I think that's one of the best things that this movie does is still show him as a product of his time. And I think it puts forth the idea that we look back on these people as being so backward thinking, and there could be a society in 15 years that views the way that we think to be just as backwards looking.
I mean, there will be, absolutely. yeah, I agree. And especially since that, I think the scene where that stuff with him and Nina is most loudly vocalized is the scene directly after the Royal Geographical Society, the big scene in the hall. But that is a scene I want to talk about, because that is a scene I actually like hate. The scene with him and Nina, I just think it's so, for a movie that doesn't hit nails on the head too frequently, that is a scene where he is having an argument with Nina where they just yell themes at each other, and I really hate it. And I think that the things that this movie does with Nina throughout the movie, and I'm not saying like that scene shouldn't be there, because there has to be some form of conflict between Nina and Percy, and outside of that scene it's all relatively calm between them. It's a very sort of understanding, Percy being like, I have to do this, and Nina being like, I know it sucks, but I know. And also it's the early 1900s, so I can't really raise my voice too many times. But that scene is like I wrote this down. Percy really literally yells this out. Men and women have performed their role since the beginning of time. It is the cornerstone of our civilization. And for a movie that does so many things so subtly, to just have Percy yell that, it just, like, even the first time I watched it before knowing what the ending of this movie was, that made me upset, specifically that line, but also just in general. And I think the idea of bringing up childbirth is fantastic. That's a good element, and so many elements of that conversation are good. Again, I think that's a conversation that in some way has to happen. I just think the way that it happens hurts the movie so, so much, because when you look at all the other elements of Nina's story, they're all sort of either quick moments that are, you know, something in the scene previously where she says, I should be with my husband on the floor of the RGS. And the guy just says, men only, I'm afraid. You know, it's like, that's really quick. And then in that same scene, we reveal that she found this document that backs up Percy's theory that Zed exists. And, you know, little things like before they go to the first big dinner, when she's getting dressed, she says she's would rather be in her trousers. She's complaining about the dress. Like, quick little things like that happen all throughout the movie. And I think if you remove or change that scene of Percy and Nina having a real blow up argument where they really yell what they're thinking, like in a very direct way, I think the ending of this movie becomes so much more powerful. And I just think it hurts the movie so much to me, because I think that ending is fantastic. The Nina ending is fantastic. And I think it's totally undermined by one scene in the middle of the movie. And it's just disappointing, you know?
And what's the Nina ending you like? Just her presentation of the compass and saying that it's her job to still believe, or?
It's her job to still believe. And the idea that she, we see her walk into the jungle at the end of that shot of the mirror, because that would be the, like, all of these little things adding up, and then you're just like, oh, she's kind of in her own sort of jungle, lost by herself as well, and it's just that Percy hasn't been giving her any of the care that she's been giving him from afar. Like, I think another key element in their relationship is the contrasting letters towards the end. One of the last scene we see them together in, I mean, it's a flashback to what seems like after Jack's baptism. They're at dinner and she says, oh, I'd like to read a note I wrote. And it's a note that she wrote in case she didn't survive childbirth, right? It's the note that ends with men's reach should exceed his grasp, something like that. And she's writing about the future that she hopes for her husband and her child. Percy's last letter to Nina, which he says in the beginning, he's like, this will be my last communication for a while, it's exclusively about his journey. It doesn't really present any sort of care about Nina. It's just like, these are the things that I found, these are the things I'm excited about, all these things. There's no like, if I don't come back, I hope you have this a nice life without me, you know?
Yeah.
There's just a total lack of consideration of Nina from afar. And it's not that he doesn't think about her or the kids, but I just think it's telling the way that this movie shows correspondence. And earlier in the movie, Percy can't even bear to like properly read a letter that Nina wrote for him before just throwing it in the fire. And I think it's just telling that even during the last letter that Percy sends out, again, the one all about his conquests and not really saying, hey, Nina, I hope everything's good with you, you know, not even that. There's this one cutaway shot of her just sitting by a window reading the letter, and the breeze is coming in through the window, and she's so alone, you know, and she's just reading this letter, and it's like she's waiting by the window for any sort of news to waft in with the breeze, you know, and it... And all of those things are things that you notice really closely on the second viewing, but start to, with that mirror shot, you're like, oh, these are things that have been going on this whole time. And then it's that one mirror shot, which is a sort of effect that you aren't anticipating in this kind of movie. I just think that ending would be so powerful if it hadn't sort of been set up in the middle as clearly as it had been. You know, it's set up very subtly throughout, with the exception of that one scene. You know?
Yeah.
And I know that's very nitpicky, but and I think that also comes from a knowledge of James Gray's films, where he has a film that my perspective of it changed entirely in the final shot. So I came into this movie not expecting him to do something like that again, but when it did happen.
On the lookout?
not even on the lookout, because like it's a shot that I never would anticipate a filmmaker trying to do again. And yeah. Because it works so well the first time, and it just sort of feels like it would be like I mean to bring in the guy we bring in every time, it would be like Christopher Nolan ending another movie with a shot of a spinning top and cutting to black, you know. Or just something spinning and cutting to black, you know. And so I never anticipated it, but I just think like it could have worked so well you know, with some slight changes in that one scene. Yeah.
Okay.
And again, I'm holding, like, it's a very difficult job to make a film, and I'm holding it to a very high standard, and I'm holding James Gray to a very high standard. But, I mean, this is what we're doing. We're talking about a movie for an hour and talking about all the things that bother us about it or that we love. And, I feel like I've talked a lot about what I love, and there's one thing that I don't, and, that's it.
Yeah. You also mentioned that, the shot in World War II or World War I, with his moment with the fortune teller, which is kind of another effects shot that you know, this movie is not full of, right? What do you get from the World War I section of this movie? Is it, I mean, it's part of the story, so it's not as though this was just added in for some reason. Was it just too important to leave out of the story and too interesting and lends itself so well to cinema, as we know war does? Or does it get us closer to something about Fawcett, or what's the purpose of that?
I think so the purpose of it is, I think you're right in that it's too big to ignore. The movie would have to mention World War I at some point, whether or not, you know, you cut out Percy actually going to war. Maybe that would be possible.
And you've already mentioned that this is where we see he's a pacifist most of the time, and then this is kind of uncharacteristically not pacifist. I mean, it would be stupid if we showed him in World War One being a pacifist, but
walking through the trenches and telling all of his men to put their guns down.
Just a bit of Hacksaw Ridge for everybody. but no, just this idea that, you know, that it does seem so counterintuitive to what we begin to know and appreciate about Percy, that to see him doing this, it's not that it's out of character, as I said, but what do we get from it?
Yeah, I think that is sort of him realizing that, or sorry, not even him realizing, just him without even thinking about it, accepting the fact that there are elements of the world that he can't fight, you know, like just world war is too big to really like be like, no, I'm not doing this. Everybody put their guns down for all the reasons that we talked about. Like, we're laughing at the prospect of him asking everybody in World War One to put their guns down because it would be impossible. And I think that's something that, again, it's the line that he says to the fortune teller about, you know, I'm looking somewhere else to quench my desires or whatever, because this world is burning itself to the ground. But he knows that there's nothing he can do individually to stop this. It's just, it furthers his desire to find evidence of a world that, or a civilization that does things properly without the idiocy of war. So I think it sort of plays into the pacifism side of things, while also furthering his desire to find another civilization. And there's a moment in that that I think is a really nice, well, nice is a weird way to put it, but a really good moment to very quickly and visually sum up something that is going through Percy's head all throughout this movie. I forget the name of the character who is going out, and it's after the gas gets announced. Costin's yelling about the gas. Percy starts yelling, and the guy that walks past, and Percy calls him back. And the guy turns back to Percy and immediately gets shot in the head, right?
Yeah.
And that idea that stopping your forward motion in any way to look backwards is immediately punished. And I think that's something that is just a very quick moment that I think really speaks to Percy as a person. And then what does Percy do? He immediately stands up and starts charging forward. Foolishly, of course, but given the situation. But that's what he does so much through the movie. And this is a time where we see him like sit still and not try and progress. And we see him try to stop somebody, and then that person immediately dies. And I just thought, like, that's a really quick moment and something that's possibly even totally unintended. But I just I think that plays into the themes of the movie quite a bit, or quite well.
Yeah.
Or at least the obsessive side of things.
And do you, how do you feel about this movie? The word that keeps coming up is classical, that this is very classical cinema or classical filmmaking. And I think that it's obviously, you know, it's a period piece. It goes from, I don't know, 1903 or 1905 or something. Obviously through World War One and beyond into the 20s, like maybe is it end of the early 30s? Maybe
I would guess it ends somewhere in the early 30s. Like the last date we see is probably 1925. Like when Percy's starting out on his last journey.
Right. Sorry. But we don't see every movie that's a period piece described as, you know, a call back to classical cinema. So what do you think it is about this movie that gives everybody that sense, or where do you get that sense from, if you do?
I do, and that's just a James Gray thing. He makes films that operate at a pace, and that pace is a lot slower than most movies. And not to say that it's boring, but he just sort of has this ability to let you sort of stew in a just like a vibe, you know, like that's a really like stonery way to put it. But there's just a feeling that a James Gray movie can sort of have over you. And it's just a lot of classical decisions. Like in this movie, I don't think he uses Steadicam at all. Even in the jungle, it seems to have been we're on a tripod or we're on a dolly, or when we can't do either of those things, we're doing it handheld. But the easy, like every filmmaker's inclination would be to use a Steadicam. And it just sort of seems that he doesn't like Steadicam. And I think that's something that, again, we're always talking about the subtle filmmaking techniques that most people don't pick up on, but we think have some sort of subconscious registering in the viewer's head. Steadicam is something that comes into existence in like 1976, you know? And by not using that tool, you're sort of saying this is a movie using ideas primarily from pre-1976. And James Gray in a lot of interviews says something like, I watch a movie every night, but that movie's always from before 1960. And that's just sort of the world that he is coming towards filmmaking with. And shot on film, which will always give a more slightly more old-fashioned sort of feel.
Right.
plays with darkness a lot, and darkness in film is where you really realize, oh, this was shot on film a lot of the time. But yeah, I think it's something as indistinct, and it's sort of hacky criticism to say it's a vibe, but it's a vibe, you know? And there's just some sort of element of his pacing and use of sound and sort of music that isn't very modern music, and just these combinations of things that add up to something that feels very old fashioned. You know?
Yeah. I think the music's there too. I think that a lot of, you know, a film like There'll Be Blood, maybe that's a bit of an extreme example for music, but it's a lot of instruments that were around at that time being played in a way that no one at that time would play them. Mm-hmm. And this isn't that. This is, it wasn't written at the time, but it's music that you could believe was written then, and just very contemporaneous sounding music.
Yeah. And I think maybe to sort of further my point about that, how this is how James Gray tends to make his movies. I think you can really tell in his movies that take place in a more current time period. Like We Own the Night is the late 80s. The Yards, I think, is either the late 80s or sometime in the 90s. The one that really stands out is, if you want to sort of feel kind of confused by the tone of a movie in a totally positive way, is to watch Two Lovers, which is the James Gray movie. It's the only movie he's made that I think takes place in the present. It came out in 2008, and I think it takes place in the mid-2000s, if memory serves. And there's just something about that movie that just feels so unique, because it just feels so old-fashioned, despite the fact that it takes place in a time period that I was alive and have a clear memory of. And I think that's the, if you're feeling confused about the James Gray feeling, and want to be way more confused, watch Two Lovers. Like, it'll simultaneously make you understand his style better, and also confuse you way more. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. And also great Joaquin Phoenix performance in that movie.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Where to from here?
I don't know. I mean, just to speak about the, you think you mentioned David Lane, or did I just read that name 100 times in reading about?
I mentioned Lawrence of Arabia. I don't know. Oh, yeah, I necessarily mentioned David Lane.
That's what it was. Yeah, we get that historical epic too that we don't see too much, and I think that lends itself to a bit of that classical filmmaking too. And I read somebody made a good point that the historical epic like this, that used to be the way that we tell these adventure stories. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there still are historical films being made today, obviously, but for the most part, you know, it's superheroes now, or sci-fi, or something like that. Like, we've shifted from history to telling kind of a more modern story. And I wanted your thoughts on that. And I think that part of it might be the racial sensitivity thing, and trying to get away from the white savior epic, which this movie, you can chime in on how you feel this kind of ranks on that scale.
It's at least self-conscious of it, you know?
Yeah, I that's kind of how I think it is too.
Yeah. Cause you couldn't make a movie like this where Andre Holland plays Percy Fawcett, despite the fact that that would be very entertaining because Andre Holland's fantastic. It just wouldn't make any sort of sense. It would, and I don't mean that, like, I mean that for in 1905, it would make no sense. Yeah. In the world for a huge portion of white people to just suddenly start listening to a black man, you know? Yeah. So,
yeah.
So yeah, it's the white savior thing is something that you just can't really work around. And this movie does it about as well as you can, you know? But yeah, and it's still there.
Yeah, but and as I said earlier, I think this movie wants you to see Percy as forward thinking relatively, but still not perfect even for the time. Mm-hmm. And definitely not perfect as time passes. So I think that that's the way it kind of invites you to be critical of it, I feel. So I think that that's part of what you said about how it manages to avoid that. Yeah. You know, that, like, with just thinking about that too, like, the Great Wall came out and everybody made fun of it, or whatever that Matt Damon
it was.
One
it was the Great Wall.
Yeah.
I did not see it, but it seemed like it was worth making fun of.
Yeah, and I just want to know, as someone, you know, he's someone who's James Graham, and someone who cares about old cinema, and the David Lean, Lawrence of Arabia stuff came up a lot in reading about this, and that transition from telling these kinds of stories in a historical standpoint to shifting to more superheroes or sci-fis and things like that, because there is a sense that these explorers kind of were, you know, not superheroes, but these individuals who, you know, literally, they say in this one, 40 million people are watching their exploits. These kind of singular brave characters that a lot of people knew and were doing things that were very dangerous. And people still do that, but other than a few astronauts, and astronauts don't really capture the imagination as much as they used to in, you know, the 60s, even the 70s. And there's too many cops, and there's too many soldiers, and spies are, you know, for the right reason, anonymous. We don't have these figures who are real people anymore, and it seems to be that it's these fictionalized versions. I just didn't know if you had a take on that transition as time has passed in cinema.
Yeah. I don't really. I will say I'm very much looking forward to the Neil Armstrong biopic that's that Damien Chazelle is working on. I think it's just like it's shitty reasoning, and I hate that I think it's right, but I think it's right. Is that it's a slippery slope, and once we started making blockbusters, and other studios were like, hey, we should do our version of that, and then just Marvel Studios started to exist, and we're just like, hey, we can make 6 movies a year, and they'll all make $1 billion. Let's just do that. I don't think there's any sort of real. I think it's mostly driven by commerce.
Yeah,
at least from a cinematic perspective. And that's it. That's my answer. You know, it's my one short answer of this podcast, I guess.
It's succinct, but I think that it's right. I think that there's probably not much more to it than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like I could talk about it for longer, but it's all going to come back to the same depressing sentence. Capitalism wins, you know? So I don't know. Do you feel like there's anything outside of that that would drive this change?
No, because I also feel that I just think that this is a really interesting time. Like this age of exploration, I think, is just an incredible part of history.
Oh, absolutely. There's a very cool Ernest Shackleton movie that could be made out of it too. You know.
Yeah, it's. But I think that, as I said, I think that once kind of astronauts stopped being as cool as they once were thought of being. And I mean, maybe it just takes going to Mars. Maybe it takes one very clear mission for people to care about it again. But I think that those figures don't really exist in contemporary culture. And to tell these historical stories, I think that you're right. I think that there's just an easier way to do it. And I think that they found it with superheroes. And what do you think is James Gray's future then?
A science fiction movie with Brad Pitt is the immediate future. And after that, I don't know. I hope because literally none of his movies have made money in America, like looking at the grosses compared to their budget. He's a highly, highly regarded filmmaker, but none of his movies have made money in America. He apparently does fantastic business in France. But he's not somebody that somebody is calling to make a smart bet on their money, you know. But hopefully, it's just sort of enough millionaires that like films keep seeing James Gray movies and keep wanting to see more James Gray movies. You know, I think it's great that he's got Brad Pitt in his corner for 2 consecutive movies. That'll definitely help, but. Even that well can run dry and will run dry, you know? But I don't know. He's, as far as I know, like him and Wes Anderson are like the last, Nolan, but he's operating on a higher level than everybody, but they're like the last really, really talented filmmakers that haven't done television, you know? And,
oh, okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, even the Coen brothers are doing TV now. Soderbergh has long since done it. Fincher, obviously, et cetera, et cetera. I know he just likes, I was listening to an interview with Sean Fennessy where Sean Fennessy actually asked him about this. And he's just like, yeah, I could see myself doing television, but I worked this long to craft stories that last this amount of time, 2 to 2.5 hours, that it just seems like I would have to totally reshuffle my priorities, you know, or my skills to make something for television.
Yeah.
And just as somebody who is pro cinema in every way, I don't want that to have to happen, but you know,
yeah,
as I've said many times, I feel like popular cinema is dying. So,
well, and even the way you talk about him telling even a new story with an old or a contemporary story with an old feeling, he seems, and judging by this film, he seems to care a lot about history and records and the permanence of things. And I think that anyone who thinks that way is, has to see that TV's very temporary, even the way that we talk about the golden age of television. It's the quality and not the permanence that I think people are appreciating. And so if that's the way that you think, it seems like cinema's still the answer.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he, again, one of the, I've read and listened to a lot of interviews with him. Something that he says frequently about the cinematic experience is that he wants it to feel like a womb-like experience. Like you're sitting in the dark and you're all just looking at the, you know, that romantic version of seeing a movie in the cinema. And he makes movies that play really well in that environment. But even he knows that some people are going to watch this movie on their phone, you know? You know, he's cognizant of that, but there's actually a really good interview with him on the Bret Easton Ellis podcast where they talk about Vertigo for like 40 minutes and just the experience of watching it when it was re-released in the 80s, as when those five Lost Hitchcock films were re-released. That's just a really fascinating interview, and whatever problems you have with Bret Easton Ellis, like he's it's very interesting listening to him talk about film. He has really good thoughts about it. But yeah, it just the way that he talks about cinema is just, it's like somebody speaking directly to my own heart. So, I mean, I tend to agree with him. And he makes movies that are perfectly designed for that quote unquote womb-like experience. And just hopefully he gets to continue making them. Yeah. And at least he can for the next one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do just want to mention a couple quick things before we wrap up. We haven't mentioned Robert Pattinson. I think he's actually really good in this. I don't totally buy the Robert Pattinson's a way better actor than you think he is argument that tends to go around a lot. But this is the one of those movies where I think he's really hit or miss in general, but I think he's just very good with very little to do in this movie. And I don't know, there's just something about the way that he says his lines, especially like the jungle is hell line in the RGS scene where he says like the jungle is hell, but one quite likes it. You know, there's like this very specific sort of way that he says it, but it just still feels very natural. And his performance all throughout the movie, I think, is worth noting. You know?
Yeah, I think it's one of those roles that is, I mean, there's not much to it, but it's still hard to do it all right. And I think he does.
Yeah, absolutely. And since we said, or since I said, we'll come back to this later, and we haven't yet come back to it, I have to talk about the shot where it's at the very beginning after he's killed the deer, and then they go to that dinner, and they're announced, and they're dancing, and everybody's having a fantastic old time. And he's hoping that he's getting, Percy's hoping that he's getting invited to dinner, and he sees the people that, I don't quite remember who they are, but that obviously control who gets into dinner. And they're talking about how he's been quote unquote rather unfortunate in his choice of ancestors. And they're just like, oh, okay, he's not coming to dinner. And then Percy sees them close the door behind them. And then we get to this cut to him standing in front of a mirror. And it's a Citizen Kane shot, basically. It's a shot from Citizen Kane, just changed a little bit because I think in Citizen Kane, Orson Welles is walking through a hall of mirrors. But Percy is standing still, and it's just this mirror, and we just see like 10 different people in that red coat well, 10 of the same person in the red coat. And it's just the idea that for somebody that is worried about how he looks and wanting to stand out from the pack and having just stood out from the pack, and then he sees this door closed in front of him, and it's not, this door closing isn't shot in an obvious way like the end of The Godfather or anything like that. It's just like, oh, he just sees the door close, and then we immediately cut to this shot where we see an infinite amount of people that look just like Percy, because that's how people see him. You know, he's just one of many. And I think that shot's great. And the last thing I want to mention is just the use of sound in the beginning and end, which I think is really cool and creative and very subtle. As per James Gray's way, the beginning of this movie, after the production logos, we've got about 30 seconds of a black screen and just the sounds of the jungle. And we fade up on that title card, and we get this presumably flash forward to the idea of a city of Zed, or at least the gates of a city of Zed, as the title card shows up. And then as it starts to fade, we hear this very military style music playing over it, fading up, and we get to that hunting scene. And then at the end, after Nino walks away, we just hear the sounds of the jungle under the title cards that play, telling that Percy never came back. Nina kept holding out hope. And as they say in the last card, early in the 21st century, people went to the location that Percy thought Zed was at and found evidence of a civilization there. And then this, again, very sort of traditional style, not quite militaristic, but a very English sounding style of music comes up and plays us through the end credits. And I just thought that's a really interesting way to kind of to show imperialism. It's this untouched world that is then sort of taken over by this different society that has decided that it controls this area. And I think that they do it both at the beginning and the ending of the movie is really cool. And it's just this really small thing that I never noticed. I saw it multiple times in theaters and never noticed until watching it again for this podcast. And I just thought it's really cool and totally worth noting.
Yeah. That there is this passage of time in the middle, and then it just ends with, as you said, this like overriding, very English sounding music, and no sense of the history. Almost this entire movie takes place on a different continent, and what you're left with is this Anglican sense of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for listening to MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next time when we'll be talking about something else.